Thanks for listening to one of our messages at Crossroads Bible Church. We gather on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. in person and online. To find out more about our church or to connect to any of our ministries, visit our website at crossroadsbible.org. We hope you enjoy the message and pray it encourages you as you seek to follow Jesus.
Good morning, everybody. Let's try that again. Good morning, everybody. Okay, we're good. It's so good to see you guys. Welcome back. We are about to close out this series on the names of God. Charlie asked me to speak twice because, I don't know, I think he wanted a break from you guys. He's tired. Youth pastor stuff. I'm the youth pastor. Have I made this clear yet? I'm tired of introducing myself that way. You should know by now, I'm not going to wear a name tag. I'm the youth pastor. I dress like one. I act like one. I talk like one. That's who I am. Everybody good? Cool. I do want to remind you that we're meeting again on Wednesday starting August 16th. Bring us your teenagers. I was joking with a couple of our small group leaders about last week how I felt like I was maybe a little desperate, sort of like begging you, like, please bring us your teenagers. But I just want to dispel that and tell you I'm desperate. Please bring me your teenagers because I love hanging out with teenagers and we need some teenagers to hang out with. So bring them. We're good. We're good at what we do. I promise. I've been here a long time. I love it. I'm not going anywhere. Bring them to us. That's enough. I do want to say that I do like to do a lot of things with teenagers. One thing I really don't like to do with them is play complicated board games. And I want to tell you why. There's a reason. I really don't mind losing certain things. There are things that I don't mind to lose. Like if we're playing like Foursquare or Gaga Ball or Volleyball or something else, whatever. If there's a kid that I can tell he really needs a win, I'll let him win. I don't care. That's fine. I'll play checkers with a kid all day long, but I'm not going to play chess with him. And I'll tell you why. I like to win too much. And if I'm playing a long, complicated game with a teenager and I can really tell that person needs a win, I'm not going to give it to them. I'm sorry. There's just too much at stake. There's too much at stake. I'll play checkers with them, but not chess. I remember, and this is not, it's not just teenagers. I remember a particular Monopoly game where I was playing with my wife and my two sisters, and everybody cried. Well, that's not true. Only the losers were crying. I was fine. They were crying. And I might have realized at that point that maybe this is a problem. But I quickly learned that it's not my problem. It's their problem. I'm very competitive. I don't like to invest a lot of time in a game and then lose. One game in particular that I am very, very big fan of and will never play with teenagers because that, I don't know, I might never speak to them again, is Risk. I love Risk. I like this game. It's long. It's complicated. It's about world domination. What else do you really want in a game but the potential to say at the end, I conquered the world? It's good. But I won't play it with teenagers. And one of the reasons I really, really love this game is because I almost never lose. I really don't. I don't even care if that makes me seem pretentious. I almost never lose Risk. And that's just who I am. The reason, though, my friends, is I have a guaranteed strategy, and I'm going to share it with you. And when I do, just know that that means I'm never playing Risk with any of you either, because now you know my secret, and I'm not going to play with you. But I will share it with you so that you can go on to dominate the world in your own time. There's a guaranteed victory strategy in this game. And if you don't know what this game is, it's basically a big board, and you get armies, and you get dice, and you try to put your pieces all over the world so that you win. The key to Risk is Australia and Siam. It really is. And I'll tell you why. If you can hold the continent of Australia, there's one country that connects Australia with everything else, and that's Siam. So if you hold Australia, you get extra people every turn, you put them all on Siam, and then slowly build out. Nobody's going to beat you because they'll leave you alone because they'll think, who cares about Australia? Who cares about Siam? And you'll think, I do. Losers. And you'll slowly inch your way out until 3 or 4 hours later, you will dominate the world and you will feel that great sense of victory that so few people get to feel, unless you're me. A guaranteed victory is very hard to come by in life. You don't often walk into situations where you know without a doubt you're going to win. You're going to get what you want, that what you want to happen will happen. Very few of you who are in sales or some sort of business walk into some sort of sales meeting where you're trying to pitch somebody on something knowing for certain that you're going to get it. It's very rare. Very, very few of us walk into a room to take a test knowing full well that no matter what, you are going to get every single question right. It's very, very rare, if ever. Very few of us ever walk onto the field of sports with a 100% chance of victory. It just doesn't happen, unless you cheat a lot, it just doesn't happen that much. The thing is, you guys probably have guessed it, we're talking about this God that wins, right? We sung about it a lot. The name that we're looking at today is the Lord of Hosts, Yahweh Sabaoth, which means the God of armies, the God of angel armies. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but that God doesn't lose. He doesn't lose. He's constantly victorious. And so we're talking a little bit today about what does that mean for us? Because I don't know if you realize this, but we don't always win. We lose a lot. We lose often. God doesn't, we do. What's the connection there? And you might think, if I know that I'm going to win all the time, if I knew that I was always going to win, wouldn't I just get bored? Wouldn't I just get complacent about it and just stop caring and not try anymore? You might think that. You might think that. But there is evidence out there that proves that maybe you wouldn't. One of my favorite pieces of evidence about this particular point happened on April 11th, 2001, in the middle of Australia. Australia was playing a game, a soccer game, in World Cup qualifying against a team called American Samoa. Now, you probably forgot that the American Samoa exists, and so did Australia. They didn't care. And they walked into that game knowing full well, yeah, we're probably going to win. Little did they know what was actually going to happen. So they go in, they're playing this game, first 10 minutes, 0-0. And if you've ever watched a soccer game, that's pretty normal. Sometimes it goes all the way through to the end of the game, 0-0. And I know that's why many of you don't watch it, but for me, I love it. I love a good 0-0 game. I don't know why, maybe it's because I'm a sadistic person, but I do like it. 10 minutes into the game, it's 0-0, and then Australia scores a goal. Hooray, good for them. And then the 12th minute comes and they score again. And then the 13th and the 16th, 17th, 18th. And by the 25th minute, it was 9-0. Australia was winning 9-0. Now, if you've ever watched the soccer game, you know this is pretty much it. No one's ever going to come back from that, ever. And then at the end of this halftime, 45 minutes of play, it was 16-0. 16-0. This is a professional international game. Now, this is that point where you might think, well, I'm sure that at the second half, they just sort of took it easy. Chilled out, relaxed, didn't push that hard, probably put all their subs in. And some of you might even be thinking, who don't know this story, hey, I bet this is that part where they, like, the underdogs, like, came back and won. Because that's the movie version of this. Here's the reality of it. At the end of 90 minutes of play, Australia held and continues to hold the world record for largest victory in a soccer match of 31-0. 31-0. Guaranteed victory does not necessarily mean complacency. In a lot of ways, that feeling of confidence that they felt when they walked back onto that field 16-0 gave them a spur of energy, a push of confidence and strength to do more than they probably thought possible. No one has ever scored that many times in a soccer game, and most likely no one ever will. guaranteed victory for them brought about an extra burst of strength and energy and passion. And I know for myself, when I was a player, we played sometimes these teams that we knew we were going to win. It gets like 3 or 4 to nothing, and you might think that's time to chill out, but it wasn't. You would feel this energy like, I want one of those goals. I want one too. And you would push harder, and you would have this strange confidence that you didn't know existed before to do things that you didn't think possible. Guaranteed victory does not necessarily mean complacency. In fact, a guaranteed victory often leads us to this feeling of confidence that inspires us to much greater action. It's a very interesting concept. And so today, when we look at this concept of Yahweh Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, the leader of our guaranteed victory, it's important to ask ourselves, what does it look like to serve a God who can't lose? Now, this name is all over the Old Testament. 240 times it's used. And it starts in the book of Samuel. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, no mention. Then we get to Samuel, and all of a sudden, it's everywhere. It's all over Samuel. It's in Psalms, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and so on. It's all over once we get there. But once we get to Samuel, that's when we start hearing this name, Yahweh Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of the angel armies. And we're going to fast forward all the way up to 1 Samuel 17. Now, Samuel, the book of Samuel, is really about the end of the time of the judges and the beginning of Israel's monarchy, particularly their first two kings, Saul and David. Now, Saul looked like a king. He was tall, he was beautiful, he was strong, and he probably smelled really good. I don't know. And he was a good kingly dude. David was a little cute shepherd boy. We're going to look at this. This book shows you a fantastic comparison of these two men. And today we're going to look at his most famous moment. In 1 Samuel 17, Saul, the king of Israel, had already been rejected by God as king. And Samuel, the prophet and final judge of Israel, was told to go and anoint this boy David to be the next king over Israel. So here we are, 1 Samuel 17. Saul, without really even knowing it, has already been rejected and a new king has been chosen. And Israel is engaged in a standoff with their really most annoying enemy, the Philistines. That little army, that little group of guys that just keeps pestering them. They just never stop. And we're in this really interesting scene where we've got one mountain over here, one mountain over here, and a valley in the middle. And Israel's army is encamped up here. Philistine army is encamped up here. And then there's this valley right in the middle. And in 1 Samuel 17, we see this scene and an army or and a man named Goliath or Goliath, as we say it, steps out. Now, you can assume that Israel already knew who this guy was. He was probably relatively well known in the camp of the Philistines. And so Israel probably seen him or heard of him before. But now he steps out into that valley. He walks down that mountain, stands in the valley between Israel and the Philistines. And he starts talking trash, starts talking junk. And he's yelling up at the army of Israel. And he says, why have you come out to draw up for battle? Why are you even here? What are we doing here? Says Goliath. Am I not a Philistine? And aren't you guys just servants of Saul? It's kind of a weak way to describe a nation. It's just servants of their king. And so he says, choose somebody. Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. And if he's able to fight with me and kill me, we will be your servants. But if I win against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. Goliath has an interesting idea. What if instead of these two armies just fighting, you guys bring your best guy, I'll fight him, and then we'll see how it goes. And so the Philistine continues. He felt like maybe that was enough. He says, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. One guy, big guy, you know, the writer of Samuel describes him as over 9 feet tall. He's got big armor. He's got giant weapons. He stands there and yells out at the people of Israel. And it seems, based on their response, which I'm going to read to you right here, that the people of Israel have forgotten something. After Goliath does this, it says, when Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistines, they were dismayed
and greatly afraid. Seems that the people of Israel, Saul their king, have forgotten something that they should have remembered. Now Goliath does this for 40 days, in the morning and the evening. He comes out, he yells at Israel, they get scared, he goes back, has some lunch, takes a nap, come back out, does it again. Then David shows up. Little boy David, little shepherd boy David, was told by his dad to bring some food to the army because his brothers are there. So he goes, he brings this food, and it just so happens that he appears when our good friend Goliath shows up. And David is confused. He is perplexed by the scene. He hears what Goliath is saying, and David immediately, David does not feel this fear and dismay. David has a question. He says, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine?" Now you might think that's a weird thing to say, and it is. That is an odd thing to question and to ask. But I think if we know what that, I think we kind of know what he's saying here. He's saying, "Who is this non-Israelite defying the armies of God? Who is this unchosen defying God's army? Who is this man?" he says. Eventually, David shops this question around to the rest of the army, and King Saul hears about it, and King Saul brings David up, and he's like, "Look, I would like to inject you with some of my fear. You're foolish, and you should stop." Saul says to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, because you're a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." I'll tell you, one of the things we do a lot in youth ministry is remind them that their age is not, in fact, an obstacle that many of them believe it to be, but is, in fact, a leverage point. Because of their youth, because of their age, and because of their lack of experience, they have the kind of confidence that can put them in situations that us, that we are afraid of. So David is this little youth boy who thinks that he can dominate this giant beast man. And Saul, the king, the anointed one of God, the one who was chosen by God himself, tries to give David some of his fear. And David says, "I'm good. I don't need it." Now David, at this point, he is a youth, and sometimes youth can be a little fiery, and they can shoot back, and they can snap back and be a little disrespectful. I'm sure many of you have never seen this before. But David had an option here to be like, "Are you stupid? Are you an idiot?" But I think we see, as we turn the pages in the same way, that David was a man who respected his authority, and he chooses to go a different way. Saul tells him, "You should be afraid. You can't do this." David is like, "I hear you, but listen. I'm not afraid. I've seen what God can do through me, and I'm not worried." He says, "Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine," it's his favorite thing to say, I guess, "shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." David remembered something that Saul and the people of Israel had forgotten. So David goes out, picks up some rocks, gets his sling, and he starts to head down the mountain to the in-between valley to meet Goliath. Now, there are some interesting moments in history that I would love to have witnessed, but here's one where I'd really love to be in the head of David. As he's walking through the ranks of Israel, many of them terrified to do what he's even considering. He doesn't have any armor on. He doesn't have any weapons other than a sling and some rocks. He's walking past these men. Some of them are probably making fun of him. Some of them are probably worried about him. Some of them are probably even saying, "Don't do it." But he just keeps walking. He keeps stepping foot in front of the other until he gets to that valley, knowing full well what waits for him there. A giant, a beast man, a scary, scary dude. But David knows something that apparently everyone else seems to have forgotten. And so we have a very interesting situation. Both of these men, David and Goliath, both are absolutely certain they will be victorious. Goliath has history and logic on his side. Goliath is 9 feet tall. He has so much armor on, I don't know how we can stand it. He has three big weapons. He is a seasoned, tested warrior. There is no reason that he or anybody in the Philistine camp should worry about whether or not this small shepherd boy can defeat their greatest warrior. It's nonsense. It makes no sense. But David is also absolutely certain of his victory because, as we've said, David knows something that apparently everyone else forgot. David knows who is actually going to fight this battle for him. David remembers the stories of Israel and the Exodus. He remembers what God did for them in Egypt. He remembers the Red Sea. He remembers Moses. He remembers Joshua bringing Israel into that land, the very land they stand on, giving it to them over and over and over and over again. He remembers Jericho. He remembers the work of the judges and Gideon and Samson and Deborah. He remembers all these things, and every step he takes toward that, he is reminded of his assurance of victory because he knows that God goes before him, that the Lord of hosts is the one who will fight this battle. And so he says to Goliath, Goliath spouts a bunch of nonsense. Are you a dog? You come in with sticks, blah, blah, blah. Weak stuff. David says to Goliath, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. And this day, the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. This is the part we don't teach in the children's ministry area. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. There has never been a better battle speech than this one. And imagine the scene. Imagine this moment. You see the army of the Philistines here, the army of the Israelites here, giant beast man here, tiny shepherd boy here, and they both start sprinting towards each other. Imagine the sound and the feeling that you would probably feel in the earth as Goliath stomps and stomps and stomps. He's got his armor on. He's got a shield bearer barely catching up behind him. He's got a sword, a spear, a javelin. I don't know, maybe he had three hands. I don't know where he's holding all these weapons. And then David saunters up with a rock and a sling, twirls it, throws it. The beast man falls. Imagine being there. Israel, I don't know. I mean, I guess Saul was taking a calculated risk here. I guess he assumed that, hey, if this boy goes out and wins, yay, we win. If this boy goes out and loses, everyone's probably going to feel a lot of sympathy. They might even feel a little righteous anger, and that might spur them to fight. There's no chance that Israel or Saul thought this was a possibility, but here it is. David, this little shepherd boy, puts his sling down, walks up, and it says, stands over the body of Goliath, pulls the sword, chops the man's head off, holds it up, and says, what? He pulls it back. He shows the Israelites. Philistines start freaking out. They're gone. Israel gets up. They chase. They pursue. Philistines leave. Israel won. Guaranteed victory. It's very hard to come by in life. But when we remember what David remembers that day, that we go forward with the Lord of hosts, it changes things. You see, David knew the outcome because he knew this Lord of hosts. He had been anointed. He was filled with the Holy Spirit, very much like us, and knew what was going to happen. You see, God's power is so substantial that we can trust in the future. And that trust can inspire confidence, which can lead us to world-changing actions. Our world may crumble around us, but we can have confidence because we know the future. We know what God is doing and what he has already done. It's another little story I want to share with you. In 2 Kings 6, I feel like this one is a little bit less well known, but it is so interesting to me. See, a prophet named Elisha, not Elijah. Elijah got up with chariots of fire. Elisha, you know, held his jacket as he did it. Elisha is brimming with confidence in the Lord of hosts, just overflowing with confidence and power as a prophet in Israel, so much so that Israel is fighting with Syria, and he just tells the king all the time, like, yeah, he's over there. Yeah, the army's coming from the south. He doesn't have any spies. He just knows. God is giving him all this, and he's brimming with confidence, so much so that the king of Syria targets Elisha himself, sends an army, chariots, horsemen, and soldiers to surround the city where Elisha's hanging out. And that morning, Elisha's servant wakes up, looks out and sees it, and is freaked out. He says, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And Elisha said, "Do not be afraid." Elisha knew something that the Syrian army didn't know, that his own servant didn't know. He knew something. I read the story, and for some reason, I go straight to Jesus on the boat with his disciples. Storming, they're freaking out, they feel like they're just about to die. Jesus is chilling, taking a nap. There's an army surrounding the city. Elisha is asleep. His servant wakes him and says, "What are we supposed to do?" And Elisha's like, "Don't worry, don't be afraid." And then he tells him something very interesting. He says, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." It doesn't say this, but I have to imagine this is the moment where Elisha's servant is like, "Who? Where? We're not an army. It's you and me. We don't have army. We don't have weapons." And then Elisha does something. It says, Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, show him what I can see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Elisha's servant got to take a peek behind the veil and see God's army. Now, you might think this is the moment where Elisha said, "And go get them." Where Elisha calls to that army of fire and says, "Defeat my enemies." But Elisha was so filled with confidence from God that he did something far better and weird. This is a weird one. After he reveals this army of fire, he prays, "God, make the Syrian army blind." So he does. And then Elisha walks out and he's like, "Hey guys, you're in the wrong place. Let me show you where we need to go." So this blind Syrian army follows this voice, this man. And Elisha leads them into Samaria where the king of Israel is. He brings them to the very palace, walks up to the king of Israel and says, "Look what I got." And the king says to him, "Should I destroy this army for you?" And Elisha's like, "I have a much, much better idea. Watch this." And he prays and asks for the Syrian army to no longer be blinded, and then they regain their sight. And he tells the king of Israel, "Why don't you feed them and send them home?" And it says, in 2 Kings, it says, I want to read this because it's hilarious. "He prepared for them a great feast. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel." Confidence in God's power and strength can lead us to inspiring, world-changing action. If confidence in victory leads to complacency, then in that moment, Elisha would have woke up, saw it, and said, "I don't know, kill those guys, and gone back to sleep." There was so much confidence in Elisha's heart because he knew the outcome of this battle, that he saw no need for violence. He saw no need for this to happen. Decided instead, "Why don't I do something crazy?" This is what confidence in the Lord of hosts can lead us to. World-changing, inspiring action. You see, when I lived around the world, my dad was in the Air Force, and so I lived in lots of different places, Spain, California, Florida, Philippines, Hawaii, Italy, Germany. That's where I grew up. And a lot of times, there would be problems. I remember when we lived in the Philippines, sometimes there was some really strong anti-American stuff going on. There would be riots, and there would be rallies, and we would all be told to come to the military base. I got to be honest with you. When those things happened, I would be scared. I'd be nervous. But there was something about entering that military base that took all that away. Because outside the base, anything could happen. But once I walked through those gates and I knew what protected me, that fear melted away. You know, when we lived in Germany sometimes in the 90s, there was still some anti-American stuff going on, and they would get angry, and there would be riots, and there would be problems, and we'd walk into that military base, the largest one in Europe. All that fear is gone. We knew there was no chance anybody was getting through there. Psalm 46 talks a little bit about this. Because, you know, I know God doesn't lose. I know God loves me, and that God's army is bigger than all the others, and in him I can take refuge. Psalm 46, I want to read this to you guys. This is, we sang this in worship this morning. This is the Message translation, so it sounds a little different, and it really gets to me. I want to read this to you. It says, God is a safe place to hide, ready to help when we need him. We stand fearless at the cliff edge of doom, courageous in sea storm and earthquake, before the rush and roar of oceans, the tremors that shift mountains. Jacob wrestling God fights for us. God of angel armies protects us. River fountains splash joy, cooling God's city, the sacred haunt of the Most High. God lives here. The streets are safe. God at your service from crack of dawn. Godless nations rant and rave. Kings and kingdoms threaten, but earth does anything he says. Jacob wrestling God fights for us. God of angel armies protects us. Attention, all. See the marvels of God. He plants flowers and trees all over the earth, bans war from pole to pole, breaks all the weapons across his knee. Step out of the traffic. Take a long, loving look at me, your high God, above politics, above everything. Jacob, wrestling God, fights for us. God of angel armies protects us. So what do we fear? I want to be clear. I'm not against fear. There are some fears that are helpful. You should be afraid to jump into the shark tank at the zoo. That's a bad idea. The fear that you feel about that is good, and God does not want to take it from you. But there are some fears that cripple us. There are some fears that live in our hearts that hold us back from that confidence in the Lord of hosts. Maybe you're afraid, as I am often, to share your faith with other people. Maybe you're afraid that it's embarrassing, or maybe you're afraid that it's going to offend them. I want to propose today that what if you remember that ours is a God with an army unmatched by any the world has ever seen? What if you walked into that conversation knowing that God had already won? Maybe we fear trusting God with our finances. Maybe we're afraid that if we relinquish control in that area, it might not work. But what if we remembered that the Lord of hosts goes with us wherever we go? Maybe we're afraid to go after what we feel God has really called us to. Maybe we're worried that there's just too much wrong with us and we'll never be made holy. Maybe we have addictions, secrets, anger, anything. What if we looked around, opened our eyes, and saw the chariots of fire, the angels armed to the teeth in support of you and God? Who can we fear? You know, Jesus, the commander of these armies, he had seen them. He knew them. He commanded them himself. He was there with Elisha that day. He met Joshua on the field of battle before he went into Jericho. He welcomed Elijah when he pulled up on that flaming chariot. He, Jesus, he knew the outcome as the whips rained down on his back. Jesus, as he wiped the spit from his face, he knew what was happening. And as the nails were driven into his arms and his legs, he did not forget where those armies were. And at any moment, he knew he could have called down an army so fierce and powerful that it would have overwhelmed every enemy that stood before him. But because Jesus had that confidence, because he knew what he could do, he did something no one ever thought he would do. Because of the confidence that came from knowing that the Lord of hosts went with him, he was able to die and change our world forever. Knowing the outcome, knowing that we walk in victory, can fill us with brimming confidence to the point that we can do world-changing things. Every single one of us. So my friends, if you don't mind, let's stand right now and let us worship with passion and zeal the very Lord of hosts who goes before us into every battle, the God of angel armies. Let's worship him today.